Hey everyone, Chad Cemetery is back, as is Tim Matthews. Today we're talking all about the 1994 movie, The Shawshank Redemption, which is directed by Frank Darabont, who is a repeat customer with Stephen King adaptations, as we will see. But it's funny, Tim, because this is actually the podcast I did on Welcome to Geekdom that spurred the idea to start Chat Cemetery. So this isn't the first time I've talked about this. Katie Schaefer and I discussed it over on my other podcast, so I'll link to that. But, you know, sometimes that's just how things happen, and I knew that I'd be discussing it again. So, Tim, thank you for coming on to discuss it.
Happy to. You regretting diving into all that Stephen King yet?
Not yet. It is a lot. I think I read 20 or 21 Stephen King books in 2019. So, you know, it's definitely going to take up a lot of my book reading time for sure. The movies less so, but I think there are some, you know, TV shows coming up maybe towards the end of this year for the podcast that are going to take a little longer to get through. You know, I think what the Dead Zone is like six seasons of TV. So that's a bit of a commitment.
I didn't even know that was a television show.
Yes, indeed it was. I'm sure a lot of people are unfamiliar with it, but that's okay. Today we're talking about a movie that hopefully more people are familiar with than the Dead Zone TV show. And, you know, The Shawshank Redemption came out of the novella Rita Hayworth and The Shawshank Redemption. They just shortened the title for the movie. And, you know, Different Seasons is actually one of my favorite King collections, even though the last story isn't quite as good as the other three, but it brought us, you know, this story, The Body, which later became Stand By Me, directed by Rob Reiner. There's just so much in that particular collection that I think wasn't typical of Stephen King at the time. You know, this isn't a horror movie. There are horrific things that happen, but it's not something that you have to worry about jump scares or anything like that happening.
Yeah, it's very interesting that it's, I feel like for a while, a lot of what most people would consider, you know, the best or, you know, the best adaptations of Stephen King books were ones that weren't based in horror, which when you say Stephen King, people think scary. You know, people think The Shining, people think It. But yeah, the Shining, I mean, we covered that one. We both, you know, absolutely, you know, love the movie. I know there's a decent amount of like Stephen King purists that, you know, don't think it's a good adaptation of the book. So when people think about Stand By Me or they think about Shawshank Redemption, not only is it interesting that they're so widely regarded as adaptations and they don't really have anything to do with horror, but at the same time, they're short stories. They're movies made out of short stories. They're not even a full Stephen King book. I find that really interesting that that's how that worked. Now, obviously, the era that we're in now, we have much more successful, you know, big blockbuster, you know, horror Stephen King.
Yeah, what I found interesting with this one in particular was that Frank Darabont had actually made a short film of The Woman in the Room, which is from the Night Shift collection. And that was one of King's dollar babies, as they've come to be known, because basically what he would do, for anyone who doesn't know, is he would give student filmmakers the rights to his short stories only. So you couldn't do this with any of the novels, but novellas fell into that category as well. And Darabont went and made a short film of one of his stories in Night Shift. And then he later asked about Rita Hayworth in The Shawshank Redemption, since it was a novella, and he literally got the rights to it for a dollar initially, but I guess quite a bit of time had lapsed, so he had to go send Stephen King another dollar. And I have a copy of the shooting script that I stumbled upon in a used bookstore back in California that I would go to when I lived there. And King and Darabont both have introductions in it, and it was just so entertaining to read through that real quick and be like, oh, wow, that's how this movie came to be. And you have this moment where you're like, wow, this movie is so successful in comparison to a lot of the other short story adaptations we have seen, or even novella adaptations. So it was just so amazing to me. And if you can find a copy of the shooting script, I highly recommend trying to do that, because it has, like I mentioned, introductions by Darabont and King. It has the full 118-page script, or at least it's 118 pages in this book. And then it has some of the storyboards and just some other notes on changes that had to be made for the movie, and it's a lot to dive into. I didn't read through all of it, but I did read enough of it to know that it's definitely a nice little addition to my collection of Stephen King material here.
That's awesome. Yeah, I'm definitely gonna have to search that out. I've been really enjoying the seeing the newly found interest that so many people are having in reading the scripts of movies that, you know, a bunch of studios now, A24 in particular, you know, is just putting the scripts out there for people to read. With how popular that is, it'd be really cool to see kind of a comeback of, you know, shooting scripts like this, where we can get just that next bit of level of information and intrigue into, you know, movies that we already love and just want to kind of dive in more for.
Yeah, and I just checked. It's $15 and change on Amazon for a brand new copy right now. They do have some used ones available as well, and that's with Prime shipping. So they are still out there, which is pretty surprising given that this movie was from 1994, and I believe this came out in 95. So the fact that they still have new copies of this floating around makes me happy as a Stephen King and a movie fan. So, you know, I think we should dive into the cast a little more here, because I have heard a few things about Morgan Freeman being a little problematic these days, making inappropriate comments. As far as I know, he hasn't physically been accused of harassment or assault or anything. So, you know, that is certainly not good on any front. And this is something you and I have talked about before, you know, on Welcome to Geekdom. And it's something that I think is certainly going to be popping up here and there throughout this, just because I'm doing everything in chronological order and things have now come out that weren't out in 94. But you have Morgan Freeman playing Red and narrating. And then you have Tim Robbins, who I think just puts on such a fantastic performance as Andy Dufresne. And they're really the main two that you need to focus on in this movie. And then you have Bob Gunton as the warden. You have Clancy Brown, who is reappearing in King adaptations again, yeah, since he was in Pet Sematary 2. I would argue this is much, much better than that.
Yeah, he's such an incredible character actor, and he finds himself in, you know, he runs the gamut of quality. Well, you know, it's everything that you can find him in. You can find him in some of the greatest things ever, and you can find him in some of the worst things ever. But he personally crushes it every time, because he feels like one of those actors that just, he will put that, you know, 120% into whatever material he's given.
For sure. And a few of the other names that stood out to me were William Sadler as Haywood, Gil Bellows as Tommy, and James Whitmore plays Brooke Hatlin. And he's sort of the old guy who has been in there for a good majority of his life. I think he's been in there for at least four decades by the time we meet him. So he's certainly an institutionalized man, much in the same way that Red is, because he has been in there for so long, and, you know, we see him being denied parole. But I think really overall this cast is fantastic for the time period, for the subject matter. It all sort of works together in a way that just was astounding. And even King was surprised that this movie got made, and that it got made at this kind of level.
Yeah, no, the cast is unbelievable. Morgan Freeman narrating, like, narration can go so wrong so easily. And obviously it's like, now it is a trope to have Morgan Freeman narrating something, you know, it's, you hear his voice on commercials and documentaries, and there's just something about how he narrates this that it's so subdued, but it feels so genuine and honest and pulls you in. You know, it never feels hokey to me. And then you have Tim Robbins, who he gives this performance that just has so many different layers to it, and he does so much with silence and just very, very little dialogue, and the tiniest bits of facial expression that will just illuminate a piece of dialogue that, you know, in the hands of somebody else may be overdone. You know, it's he underplays so much, and it's very impressive. And then the supporting roles crush it as well. I mean, the warden is just so evil, you know, in Clancy Brown. And I love Brooks. Brooks is one of my favorites, and that's, you know, when we get to that, that's just so heartbreaking.
It really is. And as far as the story goes, they do stick pretty close to the source material, even though I think Tommy has the most drastic change from the story to the movie, because the way they portray Tommy in the movie and his demise is more powerful on screen than what the book initially called for, which in the book, he just goes back to a different prison. He's basically transferred out. In this, they kill him off. And Tommy is so important because you have Andy Dufresne spending all this time in jail saying, just like everyone else, that he's innocent. And you have Red, who never really says directly that he's innocent. And I think we all kind of know he's not. But because of Andy's situation, Tommy comes in and is like, oh, hey, I was cellmates with this guy who bragged about the murders that you're in for. And it just starts this whole sequence of Andy being so determined to get out of there. You know, at first he's sort of, I don't want to say complacent, but he's just there to do his time, and he wants to get it over with as painlessly as possible, which you have, you know, the sisters who come into play. And while you don't explicitly see them rape Andy, you know that's what's happening given Red's narration and what you do see.
Yeah, it's a horrific little sequence that they go through. You know, it's definitely one of my least rewatchable parts of the movie for me. You know, it's important to set up that something like that would have and could have, you know, broken anybody else. But Andy has this kind of, he has this hope that he doesn't let go of. And, you know, the conversations that he has with Red, you know, Red, you know, kind of warns him about hope, you know, that, you know, having hope like that is dangerous. And Andy does find some kind of complacence, but he finds a camaraderie in the people he's with, and he finds a purpose in what he's doing there. And, you know, while he's there, he feels that he's doing this good to better himself by bettering the situation for the people around him, by, for instance, building the library and everything, and helping people, some of the inmates, you know, complete their, you know, diplomas and everything. And then when you get to the whole Tommy thing, I haven't read the novella yet, actually. I still need to pick up that one, but the hearing how you describe it, and I definitely prefer how the Tommy thing is portrayed in the movie. It just adds this extra level of evil on top of the warden that, you know, the warden's got Andy right where he wants him. It's like, you know, Andy's getting something out of it, you know, with the library and everything, but he's also stuck, and the warden can't lose Andy. If he loses Andy, he loses all the success that he's having. And so he, you know, to have Tommy basically assassinated is a horrific and very powerful scene. But then when Andy learns about this, you see a change in Andy. You know, that kind of hope and the strength that he has to get through day to day, that's when you definitely see the switch. It's like a big chunk of his hope was ripped away when Tommy was killed. And so as you said, you know, it's definitely that switch where he's like, I got it. You know, that's it. It's time. I got to get out of here. But the way the movie handles it, even having seen the movie so many times and knowing obviously that he, you know, he gets out, when you watch those scenes, it's incredibly tense how they really allude to he's at the end of his rope. You know, he asks for a rope. It's the way Frank Darabont frames all those scenes, you know, him walking back into the cells and looking up at Red, him sitting on his cell and holding the rope. You know, it's, they build up this tension that you're just like, is he going to do it? And then they make you wait while they go and check the cell. And it's been a long time since I saw it for the first time, so I can't really think back to how I reacted or what I thought when I first watched it. But I would imagine if I didn't know the ending that I would have assumed like, wait, did they really kill him off? Like, did he break? Because the movie goes to some dark places and it doesn't lead you from the start of the movie or as it goes to think at any time like, oh, these guys could get out of here in a positive way.
Yeah, really this whole movie and the whole story in general are a big commentary on what prison life was like, especially during the time period that this takes place during. In the movie, you have Andy arriving in the late 40s and he escapes in the mid 60s, give or take. He's basically there, I believe it's 47 to 66. So 20 years of this, and you see how not only has it chipped away at these men day by day and year by year, but you also see how dysfunctional the ones who get out are. You see the librarian, he's so old, Brooks, that by the time he gets out, he has no idea what to do. He's kind of just like, what are these cars going, you know, driving around everywhere? He nearly gets run over pretty much his first day out because he has not seen the outside world in so long, and it's so different from when he went in. He just can't handle it. Red is a little more resilient when he gets out because of the hope that Andy gave him. And, you know, this is a story and movie that has a lot of really good quotes, I would say, that you could pull from it. And one of the ones highlighted in the shooting script is, hope is a good thing, maybe the best of things, and no good thing ever dies. And that is such a powerful line because Andy never loses that hope, no matter what's going on, whether it's the sisters attacking him, whether it's Warden Norton using him and laundering money, or not laundering money, he is stealing money from the prison, basically. And
yeah,
you have
pretending to be laundering it.
Yeah, you have so many things going on, and Andy is just in the thick of it, but he never loses hope. And that's the important thing that I think this story tells you. If you don't lose hope, you can make it through literally anything, including decades of prison time.
Yeah. Along the line of just like so many great quotes, like with him, you know, when he's explaining to Red how he's, you know, funneling the money and everything, he has this amazing smirk on his face when he says something like, you know, I was as straight as an arrow, you know, before this place. And he says, like, I had to come to prison to be a crook. He's able to find this twisted positivity in his lousy situation. You know, he's stuck there. He shouldn't be there. You know, he's the only innocent man in Shawshank, you know, and he's with Red, who admits to Andy when Andy says to him, did you do it? And Andy expecting Red to say, no, he's innocent. Red's response is the only guilty man in Shawshank. You know, it's, so they have this, it's, it's this really incredible parallel between their characters, between their friendships. And the movie does such a nice job portraying how much time goes past. You know, it's just in such subtle ways, but the movie just takes its time, and we get to live with these characters for better and for worse, you know, in their light moments, in their really crushing and dark moments. You know, it's the balance of that hope and loss of hope is done so incredibly well. And, you know, as you mentioned, Brooks, the line that sticks out to me is when he's just like, I saw a car once. You know, before he was in prison, he saw a car once, and now he's out. And there's just cars everywhere. This life is everywhere. And the fact that he tried to kill one of his friends just because he didn't want to leave, because he was fearful of leaving. That's the only life that he knows anymore. It's so interesting to see how the prison affects each of them differently.
Absolutely. And at the same time, you have all of these guys experiencing this thing together. So then there's this sense of camaraderie throughout too. And Red is the guy who knows how to get things. So he's mm-hmm. kind of the most well-liked as far as with the prisoners goes, because he's the one getting them the cigarettes and he's doing this and that just to make sure they have some sort of thing to call their own, whether it's, you know, their smoking habits or, you know, the Rita Hayworth poster that plays such a big role in this because it covers up what Andy's been doing for 20 years. And yes, the poster does change every now and then, but by the time you get to that 20th year, everyone just thinks he's the smart guy doing everyone's taxes and carving rocks.
Yeah, he's staying under the radar while also being so noticed and, you know, regarded in the prison. But it's because he's just helping everybody out. It's just kind of like, oh, well, Andy's Andy. And, you know, he has these moments of standouts of, it's interesting that it's like his idea of standing up against the authorities is him locking a guard in the bathroom so that he can blast opera for the entire prison to listen to. And he just sits there and turns the volume up. You know, he's not inciting violence or anything, and it still gets him in trouble. But then once he's back out, you know, he's back to doing what he does with the warden, because he set himself up to be so reliable to so many people in the prison. And whether it was his intention or whether it just happened that way, it allowed him to kind of, if he steps out of the bounds just that much, you know, he'll pay for it, but he'll be back to the level of regard that he was in before, because he's necessary.
Yeah, I really don't know how much more I'll have to say about the story, because there's just so much that it gets right. And the way that Darabont adapted this, you have this movie that is paced so well, given how much time it covers. You aren't spending the movie going day by day. There are a lot of time jumps, and you don't even really need to have it up on the screen like, oh, it's this year, or it's this year, or it's this week in this year. And instead, you have Red narrating the whole thing, and you just get this sense of how much time has passed without necessarily explicitly needing to be told how much time has passed. You can see them aging a little more. So I think the pacing worked wonders for this movie. And it is a longer movie. It's about 2 hours and 20 minutes. And I think at the time, it was one of those things where this was a risk to be taking, because this movie really doesn't have a ton of action in it. It's not some big explosive escape plan from Andy. It's this quiet thing that he's been planning for 20 years, and it's much more subtle than what you would expect from a movie that is about a prison break at some point.
Absolutely. And I think one of the really smart things about how Darabont films it is there's not really at any point in the movie that they lead on that this is a prison break movie. You know, it's, they very easily could have tried to hook audiences in by calling it, you know, Escape from Shawshank or something like that. You know, it's it because the Prison Break movies, they sell well, you know, but it's the fact that it's just called The Shawshank Redemption. And then it's this slow but well-paced, contemplative, you know, almost like a buddy movie after a while. Like, it's just these groups of friends that are, you know, especially when you get to the scene on the roof, where, you know, because he helps out the guards with their taxes and everything, that, you know, he helps out his buddies to get him some beers, and they just get to relax out there like normal guys. And, you know, it builds this, you know, kind of unbreakable friendship between all of them. As you're watching the movie, even knowing that he escapes, I never find myself like sitting there thinking about the escape. I'm just thinking about almost just like the little vignettes of time that we get with all the characters. And I'm so invested in each of them. You know, even when you bring Tommy in, you know, you bring this new guy in, that could go so wrong. But Darabont does such a nice job fleshing out these characters with just the tiniest bit of information that we need. And that's enough for us to care about who this character is, whether it's something we know about their backstory or whether it's just the relationship that they have to the characters that we're focused on. And so by the time we get to the escape, it's just like, oh my gosh, like this is this incredible, you know, moving moment rather than an exciting chase. You know, it like you said, it never, even when you get to the escape, it never boosts into, you know, an action movie. It's just this wonderful triumphant achievement of him just getting out, and then followed by seeing how that affects Red and the people that he left behind. They think so fondly of him and they miss him, but, you know, they're clearly happy for him. You know, it's, I just really appreciate how it stands out apart from a typical Prison Break movie in that way. And it's like you said, it's remarkable how well that works. And it is a long movie, but it doesn't feel that way, because you kind of just, you just settle in with all the characters. And then next thing you know, it's over, and you kind of oddly, you want more time with them. You're like, I feel like I really got to know all these people and I want more time with them. I want to hang out with Red and Andy on the beach a bit. You know, I want to, what's Andy been up to? You know, has he opened his hotel? Like, what's going on?
Yeah. And the thing with this being a novella initially, I think sometimes those lend themselves to being adapted really well, because we've seen time and time again with the It miniseries, the It movies, the Stan miniseries, and, you know, another series is going to be coming out soon. Some of his longer works, and those two are very, very long, and <Yeah. laughs> it's just so hard to adapt them because you have to pick and choose so many different aspects. Here, yes, you have stuff that changed, but for the most part, the crux of the story remained the same, and you got all of the important details that you needed. You have the opening scene with Andy's wife cheating on him. You have his trial. You have him walking into the prison day one. You have these things that really do need to be in the movie for you to understand the full context of the story. And because the novella is not all that long, it helps. And this is easily one of my favorite King adaptations, and I think he agrees because he was pleasantly surprised by how good this was. He even had George Lucas watch it before it was released, because with the Dollar Babies, the deal was King had to get a copy before it was released and watch it. And I guess he shared it with some other people, George Lucas being one of them, and George Lucas liked it. So that goes to show how powerful this movie was at the time from Darabont, who wasn't really known super well in Hollywood at that point.
Yeah. And I don't believe it did well at first. And I think And I don't know if the, I haven't really looked further into this, so I don't know if this is just one of those like legends and it's not actually true. But
I know it got a lot of award nominations, especially at the Academy Awards, but I do think you're right that monetarily it didn't necessarily fly off the charts or anything. It was one of those things where certain Stephen King adaptations just didn't hit as well at the box office. And I wonder if that could be because this wasn't a typical King horror movie. And I don't know the exact details on like opening weekend numbers or anything for this, but
I'm not sure.
I do remember hearing something along those lines.
I think it got re-released after the awards, because I think after the awards, people were like, wait, like that movie was really good. And I think there was a lot of buzz. So I think it did get re-released and ended up, you know, I think it ended up, you know, being a success. You know, I don't think it was, you know, a huge blockbuster. But again, I could be wrong on how that played. But I do know it beyond that, it had quite the life on cable television. I mean, even when I was growing up, I'm pretty sure probably the first time I saw it was probably watching it on like TNT with my dad, you know, because it that and that's how a lot of Stephen King stuff was for me growing up. It was my it was my dad being like, you got to check this out, and me sitting and watching it with him, and me probably not being, you know, super of age to be to be watching them. But you know, it's I have very, very fond memories of catching a lot of Stephen King stuff on cable, and this was no exception, and it was on all the time. And so I think it definitely was one of those ones outside of the theaters that I don't even want to say it was a cult following. I just think it was a delayed success. It's definitely not cult status. It's definitely widely regarded as a wonderful and incredible film.
Yeah, it's not one of those movies where it's something like, you know, Silver Bullet, for instance, maybe, where it's this werewolf movie that isn't super mainstream and isn't going to hit with a lot of audiences. But I know you happened to just watch that, so that's why I brought it up, because it just got a great Blu-ray release.
Yeah.
And, you know, that I think is more along the lines of a cult following for that movie.
Definitely.
And I looked it up on Box Office Mojo real quick. The opening weekend for this was 727,000. So that's you know, less than a million, not fantastic. Overall, it made over 28 million, and only about 85,000-86,000 of that came from overseas. So it wasn't as widely available as it is now. And I know they did a 10-year anniversary re-release, and they did one in 2019 where I know it was showing in some theaters. Like once or twice a day, it wasn't anything big by any means. It's not like everyone could go see it in every theater. It was certainly a limited release, but it's a movie that I think has done super well with the home video release, the digital release, Blu-ray releases. You know, it's one that people are still buying, so therefore people are still releasing it in new formats.
Yeah. I'm curious to see, speaking of, you know, how Stephen King movies and adaptations don't necessarily hit right away, I'm really interested to see, now that Dr. Sleep is on its way out onto, you know, home video and everything, I'm interested to see how that film's life might build. Because it was definitely one of those ones that, I mean, everywhere I looked around, people were talking about it positively. I mean, the critics were talking about it positively, but it just didn't make money. And it was just super bizarre. I don't know if it was the timing. It was definitely weird that they would throw it out there, you know, after Halloween, you know, and some people say that people didn't know it was a sequel to The Shining. I mean, I feel like the marketing was pretty clear on that, but maybe just because I was looking for it.
Or because people like you and I already knew, we're just like, what? How do they not know?
Exactly. So maybe general audiences are seeing that and just seeing something called Dr. Sleep and are just like, what? Like, what is this? Why? It looks kind of weird with these, like, you know, mind wizard vampire things.
To be fair, it is kind of weird.
Oh, for sure.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah, same. And I'm curious to see, and I hope that the word of mouth, you know, gets more people to check that one out on video as well. Cause it was a shame to see that not do well in the box office.
Yeah.
I hope it's not one of those ones that scares studios off. Cause that's always the nerve wracking part when, you know, this movie, if it didn't do that well, it could have scared studios off of making, you know, films like this and allowing films to really take their time, especially in 94 when a lot of edgy action indie stuff was coming out. And this is kind of more of an old school feel of a film. So it'll be interesting to see how that turns out. But as far as this one, we're getting a lot of Stephen King, you know, remakes, you know, with Pet Sematary and stuff like that. I don't think anyone would attempt to remake this. I hope they don't. Because this one I still think stands the test of time. Mm-hmm. And has a timeless feel to it. You know, I think Stand By Me is still a fantastic film, and I think does stand the test of time for the most part. But I don't think, and I might catch flack for this, but I don't think Stand By Me is as necessary to be protected from being redone. I don't think they should, because I think there's tons of Stephen King that we should, you know, focus on. He's got a lot of work that we can dive into instead of just redoing stuff. But this one, I feel like it's just one of those ones where it's just like, there's nothing about this that you're like, oh, we could do that better. You know, watching it yesterday, I was just still utterly blown away by every frame, every piece of dialogue and the score. It's just, I was mesmerized. And then when it was over, I sat and I watched the entire credits. Like, I was like, this is just amazing. I was like, I'm just going to sit and think about this, even though it was the umpteenth time I've ever seen it.
There are definitely certain adaptations that people just shouldn't touch. I feel like this, Stand By Me, you know, The Green Mile, those are sort of three of the ones from, you know, the 80s and 90s period that I think are really top tier movies. And I really hope nobody is going to do those. There are certain ones that you understand why they're redoing them because of the advances in technology. But this is a movie that needs no effects.
Right.
You don't need to CGI anything in this movie. You don't need really a whole lot visually for it to work either. You know, prison is a drab place from what I can tell. Haven't been there, but it seems like they picked the perfect place to film this. The cinematography is fantastic too.
My boy Roger Deakins.
They do such a great job with framing these shots, you know, after Brooks commits suicide and you just see that Brooks was here. And then later you see, and so was Red. It's just one of those things where the imagery in this is so powerful, and the way they framed it just hit you even harder. You're just like, God, this looks so good. And it hurts so much because the story is a sad story in a lot of ways. You know, people all the time go to prison for things they didn't do. And I wouldn't necessarily say like most of the people in prison are innocent. I don't think that's the case, but you have a lot of instances where people are wrongly accused and wrongly convicted. And back then there weren't as many steps that you could take to get those convictions overturned. So Andy just takes things into his own hands. And with the cinematography, you just see how it all comes together. Especially on multiple rewatches. I think this is one of those movies where you can't just watch it once and notice everything. It's one where I think every time you watch it, you're going to notice something new or something different.
Absolutely. Yeah, like one of the things, you know, speaking of cinematography that I really, you know, focused on this one is, I mean, anytime I watch anything shot by Roger Deakins, I'm just utterly mesmerized. I don't even really like the movie The Village, but it looks incredible because Roger Deakins shot it. But in this one, I particularly love the way he uses colors, and especially the lack of colors, you know, how throughout the prison, everything is so muted. But then like you have a scene on the roof where they're sitting in the sunshine and there's this brightness to the colors that come in, and that, and it's still meshed with the dreary, you know, prison in the backdrop. But then you get, you know, to the end, you know, inside the bank, there's so much color. There's life in Andy's face. When Red gets out and he, you know, and he's on the road and he's walking through the fields looking for the tree. So many bright and vibrant colors, you know, especially the beach. You know, even when Brooks gets out, it's really interesting how he's out of prison, but it still has that very muted colorscape.
Yeah.
And it's very much because he's not comfortable. You know, he doesn't feel free. He doesn't feel safe. And so it's little things like that. They aren't things that you notice on first, second, third, you know, fifth, seventh, whatever watch. But there are things that when you're just kind of sitting, you're just like, because you already know all the other beats. So you're watching these other things and you realize that stuff like that, you know, the way something's shot, the way a music cue comes in without you even realizing it, that's just the best part about movies to me, is that the tiniest things like that affect how you react to a movie, whether you realize that those things are happening or not. You know, the majority of people that I talk to, when I start talking about cinematography or editing or something, they just kind of like their eyes glaze over. And they're like, yeah, whatever. Okay.
I'm slowly learning more and more about it as I do this podcast. I don't know any technical terms for any specific shots or anything. So apologies if I ever get those wrong. I know framing is a thing, though. That's a thing. That's all I got.
Yeah. There's a complexity, but a simplicity to it. And it's, you know, I love watching for those things. But it's amazing how affecting those things can be when the majority of people, they don't care. They're not thinking about those things. They're not watching those things. But the filmmakers put so much of those little aspects into it because that's what makes us feel something in these movies. And this movie knocks it out of the park with all of those aspects, you know, left and right. You know, you know, you mentioned Darabont is no stranger to Stephen King. You know, it's this movie is an incredible achievement. This is definitely, I think, my favorite, you know, piece of his work. I'd have to look at his IMDb, but I feel safe in saying that. But then, you know, I won't say anything specifically about The Mist because I don't think you've gotten to that yet.
I have not. I have not seen that one before yet either. I have seen The Green Mile before, so that'll be a rewatch when I get to that, which Darabont also did.
Okay. So and so it's like if you think Shawshank and then you think Green Mile, they're different tales, but you know, they're both, you know, in a prison.
Yeah.
It's great to see what he does with this one and what he does with that one. And then you get The Mist, which is, you know, completely different and, you know, more of a Stephen King monster flick, that it shows the incredible range that he's able to cover. You know, I'm kind of losing my train of thought.
I understand what you're saying. Yeah. Totally. It's one of those things where his work with Stephen King adaptations sets such a high bar, despite the stories being quite different. And, you know, finding out that he did a 30-minute short of The Woman in the Room.
Yeah, I didn't know that. I'm going to have to search that out if it's able to be seen.
Yeah, and I know with this podcast, I'm not covering every little thing. I did cover The Lawnmower Man because I was able to find that on YouTube and get the director of it on the podcast for that episode. So that was one of the things where I was like, okay, I know this was a student film, but it's sort of the only true adaptation of The Lawnmower Man. And the later Lawnmower Man was controversial. So, you know, maybe I'll have to find this and do a bonus episode on it because now I'm intrigued. I was like, oh, it's the first thing that he has a credit for on IMDb. I'm in. Let me see if I can find that somewhere.
Yeah, for sure.
But I know if you and I go on much longer, we'll just end up repeating ourselves and talking about, you know, this movie is great, this movie is great. So do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up here? 5 out of 5, is that what you give this?
Yeah, absolutely. Same. You know,
It's so good.
5 out of 5 and just, you know.
And we're done.
I miss my friend.
Well, that is a good place to wrap this up. Tim, thank you so much for coming on to talk about this one.
Absolutely. Anytime. If people haven't watched this, dude, what are you crazy? Go watch it.
Yes, do that. Hopefully before you listen to this, because we definitely spoiled all of it. But before we go, I quickly want to let you know that you can support the podcast on Patreon. We have $1 a month tier to generally support this podcast and my other podcast, Welcome to Geekdom. You can get yourself a Chat Cemetery sticker for the $2 a month tier. I will send that out to you. You can find us at Chat Cemetery on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. And as always, thank you all for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.